Peggy Sue Wells. WBCL is able to encourage your heart thanks to the area businesses that team with you to support us, like Amy Sprunger Photography, headquartered in Bern, providing the region with professional photography since 2001. On the topic of business, columnist Ann Landers said, "Opportunities are usually disguised as hard work, so most people don't recognize them." Richard Branson said, "People talk about work and play as if they are separate things, with one being there to compensate for the other. But all of it is life. All of it is precious. Don't waste any of it doing something you don't want to do, and do all of it with the people you love." The first instruction that God gave to Adam was for Adam to care for the Garden of Eden. Genesis 2:15 says, "The Lord God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it and watch over it." God created a grand and beautiful garden and then invited man to partner with God in management and cultivation of the garden. There's a holiness, it's a sacredness, a partnership with God to work. It is much more than doing the 9-to-5 grind, living for the weekend, and complaining about the man. To talk about the business of business, with us today in studio are friends and businessmen, Dwayne Ducharme and Dr. Mitch Cruz. Dwayne Ducharme has been CEO or owner of more than a dozen companies, traveled to more than 50 countries, sold one business for $35 million and another for $54 million. As a businessman, Dwayne has earned more than $125 million in his lifetime. Dwayne is the Northern Indiana State Representative for Celebrate Recovery. Dr. Mitch Cruz is our guest on Mid-Morning, the third Tuesday of every month, to talk about all things spiritual. Currently, Mitch is doing a series titled Themes and Threads of the Bible. Additionally, Mitch is host of the television program The Restoration Road with Mitch Cruz, where he teaches the Bible through stories of restoration. He's the author of the book Restoration Road and another one coming out probably this summer. Mitch Cruz is the youngest licensed realtor in the nation and the first person to sell a vehicle for a documented $1 million cash. For 17 years, Mitch Cruz was owner, CEO, and auctioneer of Cruz International, the world's largest collection of car sales organization. Mitch and his wife, Susan, are the parents of four daughters. If you have questions for Dwayne Ducharme and Mitch Cruz about business, you can text your questions to 260-745-9090. Send your questions over Facebook, email midmorninglive@wbcl.org, or call when phones open at 10:30. That number is 260-745-9090. Also, we are giving away two copies of a kid's book called Kidpreneur, Young Entrepreneurs with Big Ideas. And this is being given away by email. If you have a young person age 8 to 13, email your snail mail address to midmorning@wbcl.org. Thank you, Dwayne and Mitch, for spending the hour with our listeners.
Thank you very much, Peggy Sue. It's good to be here, especially with Dwayne Ducharme. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for having me this morning. It's a real privilege and honor to be here with you two pillars in the Christian community.
Dwayne, what prompted you to launch a business? Tell us about your business experience.
Oh, my. Well, it's a great question. Probably my first experience was a franchise called the Journal Gazette when I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
a paper boy. I was first shot at being my own boss, really. It had all the elements of the business. You know, I had to purchase inventory. I had to repackage it. I had a transportation department, which was my bike. Right? There was distribution, delivery. There was accounts payable, accounts receivable, and then there's collections and some bad debt, believe it or not, for a 12-year-old.
That's awesome. Yeah. In Hicksville.
In Hicksville. Wow. Hicksville, Ohio. Yes, sir. Yep. And then as a probably the first real business I got into was as a 19-year-old. I was a franchisee for a Marathon gas station out at the corner of Anthony and Washington. 19 years old, I borrowed money and bought inventory and everything, opened up a gas station as a lessee owner of it, basically, and quickly ran into cash flow problems, all right? Mm. Not being able to, I talked probably about 5-6 months into it, and not being able to make rent and pay accounts payable, and therefore I did the thing that a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of people do, but anyhow, I started using payroll taxes to meet the expenses and everything. And needless to say, I soon got a knock on the door from the IRS. They walked in, and I was subsequently shut down and then went in and talked to an IRS auditor. And what a lesson that was on how not to run a business, because I spent about three years working in other jobs paying off the IRS debt that I had or the payroll taxes I had. And meanwhile, people were driving around town with parts on their cars that they owed me money for. I never got collected. So it was a great lesson that served me well throughout my life.
Yeah. And the IRS doesn't play really nice. They have lots of fees on top of fees on top of fees if things aren't up to date.
Oh, yeah. All kinds of penalties and everything. And they got their job to do, though.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any problem with that and everything. But probably the first major business I got into was a tax consulting business. That was in my late 20s or so. And I worked in the Allen County tax assessor's office here. I was property tax assessor's and saw that there's a lot of mistakes being made. So I decided to open up a business appealing property tax values and tax being paid by businesses. And this was 1972. John McMillan, a really great guy, joined me shortly thereafter. This was, I think, it's been 45 years ago. And we opened up in a real small, I think it was about like a 10 by 10 office with one incandescent bulb hanging from the ceiling, one phone. It was just the two of us in there and said, okay, now what we got to do? Well, it was 22 years later, we had grown it to 26 offices across the country and one in Toronto, 325 employees, and then sold it out to the employees. Did an ESOP, and it's still thriving today. They just moved into
That's
the Ash
awesome.
Building downtown, yeah. And all these people took it to higher levels, much higher levels than what we had it at. They've just done a wonderful job with it. I'm real proud of them, really.
Wow. Can I ask him a question?
Yeah.
He sort of answered it, but I mean, how's that make you feel when you you're really gifted, and you took something to a significant level? And then you watch a group of people, you said, take it even further. Did they do things differently than you had done them? Did they take a different kind of risk, go down a different path? What made it multiply so much after you were gone?
Oh, it's a great question, Mitch. I think the finest compliment a person can do is to have somebody take something and grow it even further.
Yeah.
That means you've picked well.
Yeah.
But new people coming in are going to bring fresh energy, fresh ideas, fresh thinking, all kinds of stuff. And it was just neat to see it happen, really.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
So, Dwayne, did you want to go on with what you did after you sold that business? What did you go into next?
Well, it's like a Heinz 57 variety as we talk, all right? I had a grain farm operation at one time, and now it can be considered small. It was about 1,100 acres, and I was in that for about 10 years. I had a Florida construction company and located in Bonita Springs, which is just north of Naples, and at its apex, it was grossing about $50 million a year. I had a Florida real estate development company that was in existence for about 15 years, and we had a cumulative sales of almost $500 million. In fact, it was over $500 million in real estate sales.
Hmm.
Mostly Velominians in the million or $2 million range and everything. But it was a hot market when we were in there. We got in there in the early 80s and through the 90s and everything.
Where were you selling those?
Around Bonita Springs.
Oh, it was all there?
And Naples, yeah. Collier County, if you're familiar with a lot of Fort Wayne people get down
Miles
there.
Miles Collier has a nice car collection.
Yeah.
One of the best in the world.
Great friend of yours, huh? Yeah. And I got into thoroughbred horse racing and was in that for, about 5 or 6 years. And that was a hobby that turned into a business. I think it was 47 horses at the apex of that, and that was a $3 million lesson on how to lose a lot of money in a little bit of time.
Did you ever have, I didn't know this, I don't think, did you ever have business transactions with Tom Chauncey in Scottsdale?
No, I don't know.
We had our collector car auction at his ranch. He was quite a guy. He was John Wayne's friend, and he had some of the greatest horses in the world. I remember he took my oldest, was just a little girl, and he's showing her a horse, and somebody said, "How much was that one, Tom?" He goes, $2 million, you know, and that was way back.
It's an expensive sport. Most mine were in Kentucky, around Lexington, and we had a horse farm operation out by Columbia City also, where we did a lot of breeding and raising them, and then sent them off to the track.
I just don't think I realized that was you. I'm well aware of all that. I didn't think that was you.
That's the gambling part of me you don't know about. <the major>. Yeah.
So, Mitch, as you jumped in and talked a little bit about you, you have come from a family of businessmen. So how has that impacted the choices and the career path that you took?
My great-grandfather was really renowned in this area for clerking and cashiering auctions on the fly. So a guy would say, 50, 75, sold, 75, something like that. And he would take the money, clerk it, do everything right on the spot. So when my grandfather, his son-in-law, when Russell Cruz had his farm flood, you can see it from 69 where he was. It's just past Ingle Road. And carp were swimming where his crops should be. His father-in-law, my great-grandfather, said, you know what? This happens about every 7 years in this business. You ought to become an auctioneer. And so he went to auction school. He became an auctioneer, did really, really well. And that was 1952. In 1959, my dad, during his senior year of high school, made a deal with the principal that he could work with his dad's business, and he played sports and everything as long as he would keep his grades up. So when you grow up in that kind of thing, an auctioneer family, they don't talk to you a lot about being a doctor. So you're told that this is what you're going to be. And it's sort of like the watchmaker in Germany. You know, they raise watchmakers.
Sure.
And when you think about it, it reminds me of this story that happened to me. I was sitting with the real estate department of Union Pacific Railroad, their real estate division, at my conference room in my office, and I was pretty young, but I was making a transaction with them to sell all of their excess real estate at auction. And something came up about my youth. And a guy speaks up who had kind of been the leader of bringing me to the table to their business, and he said, Mitchell wasn't allowed to watch cartoons when he was 5 years old. He said he had to go to auctions, and sometimes it was 3 or 4 on a Saturday morning. He said he's been around auctions, carrying clerk sheets, working the ring, auctioneering for years. And the way I look at it, he has more experience in the auction business than any of us have in our jobs. So I'll never forget that. It was really, really cool. But there's something about that that instills it in you. Like, I can hear my dad auctioning when I auction. It's interesting. So I learned from whom I believe was the best in the world. And I thought I was going to do something else. I didn't, if I were picking professions, I probably would not have picked an auctioneer. But I found out that I could develop those skills and be really, really successful, probably much quicker than anything else I could do. What was unique about my situation is my dad was in significant financial trouble. Basically from growing too fast, they financed the purchase of collector cars, and they weren't a bank, and they shouldn't have done that. And then enough people don't pay, you can't pay the seller. So it became a real problem. Yeah. So I made it my mission to kind of restore. I write about this in Restoration Road, but I kind of made it my mission to restore the family business. And I really think God honored that and blessed that. And then I went through my own trials later, because it's just like Deuteronomy says, after you go, if you have a little bit of success, you might say to God, hey, look what my hands did, and that's what I did. And so I put God in my back pocket as an insurance policy, and found the greatest way to avoid heart transformation is to maintain control of your own life and just take that life insurance, so to speak, from God. So I have a unique perspective. At a young age, I had tremendous success. I had tremendous failure. And then I got on my knees beside my bed and said, God, I need you. I'm surrendering what I'm holding back, what I've held back from you, and that's my business. And now, that ironically, that it's worth nothing, I'm willing to surrender it to you. And from that point on, I said, I don't know what I'm asking. I'm not making a deal with you, but I want you to make my business a ministry. And from that point on, I experienced things that are very difficult to describe. It's just mind-boggling.
Just been amazing. the thing that's common in both of your stories is there is failure for people that are going to build business, but there's one of two responses that you can do. You can fold up and quit, or you can learn from that and move forward. So, Dwayne, what are the common misconceptions that people have about business owners and about becoming a business owner?
Oh, boy, that's a deep question. The people on the street, I think most misconceptions I hear are around the finances of it. I think that they think businesses, is that they've got it easy. Mm-hmm. You know, all they do is show up, open up the door, and the mm-hmm. cash just comes rolling in. And that all of them are rich, successful, and have money to burn. You know, mm-hmm. No budgetary questions at all. And that business owners actually make a killing. And that I think a lot of people get confused about gross income versus net income. So,
mm-hmm. What is the difference?
Well, the gross is what you take in from a sale. I mean, I'm just going to make it up like it's a $100 sale. Well, there's a cost of goods that goes into that. I mean, it could be a goods or a service, but you've got overhead, and that's the expenses. So your gross income less your expenses is your net income.
So the expenses are going to be that you had to purchase that item before you sold it to someone,
right.
Or you had to create it. So there's materials one way or another.
Sure.
Then there's the people that are going to get a salary for that.
Absolutely.
Then there's the rent. Then there's the electricity. Then there's the taxes. And so what's left is not 100% of what the sale was.
Yeah. All those things are what we call burden.
Mm-hmm.
It's a burden on the business.
So yeah.
I look at it like a mule almost with big backpacks on. It's all this burden that you're shouldered with as a business person.
And I do hear that from employees. They think, they've got money. And a lot of times the business owner is actually sweating it out and trying to make sure that they're collecting what is owed them and keeping it up to date. And both of you have experienced when that doesn't happen.
Correct.
Double correct.
When you're an owner, the way God's designed it, authority and responsibility are equal. Authority without responsibility is supremacy. Responsibility without authority is slavery. And God's designed that they go together. And so when the money, marketing, and management buck stops with you, you start having a holistic perspective. Our country was founded on owners.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have a stake in the game. You look at things differently. And I really think one of the greatest risks of this generation is we're enabling them to not think like owners. And it will carry enormous consequences.
Mm.
Enormous.
Exponentially.
Yeah. So I think that's the misconception, is that I remember when things were really, really good and I kind of got a little bit closer to what God wanted, I think, for me. And it wasn't an ego thing. It was actually an expense thing, an efficiency thing, and it was also a family thing. I leased a jet for about probably 6 years, and it gained me 30-some days a year that I used to restore myself, because about 10 years of working through vacations and around the clock and, you know, workaholism, it takes a toll on you.
Sure.
In a way that's really difficult to even explain. And so I felt guilty getting home at night and then maybe taking a few hours the next morning to kind of regroup and mm-hmm. restore. It just wasn't me. And it took me a while to even begin to value that. But that time machine really enabled me to do some other things. It also generated revenue. I could go see a customer who might want to sell his whole collection on my way to a car auction. I could bring buyers with me to a collector car auction. So it really was really good for me. But I remember one time a guy saying, "Oh man, you got it made.
Yeah,
you're in control of your own life and get to do whatever you want to do.
You're your own boss."
Yeah, exactly.
And this fun.
And it comes back to that responsibility and authority thing. And somebody who takes that seriously, you never really feel like you got it made. You never do.
Mm.
A famous billionaire gave like a gazillion dollars. I think it was a billion. To, I think, the United Nations. And somebody asked him about it, and he says, "I wake up every morning afraid I'm going to lose it all."
Mm-hmm.
So financial security never comes. It never comes. We always want more. We always feel like we might lose it. Proverbs even talks about how riches can have wings like eagles and fly away. So
it's 10:20. I'm Peggy Sue Wells. You're listening to WBCL's Mid-Morning Talk Worth Talking About. Our in-studio guests are Dwayne Ducharme and Mitch Cruz. If you have questions for Dwayne and Mitch about business, you can text your questions to 260-745-9090. Send your questions over Facebook or email midmorninglive@wbcl.org. We will open the phones at 10:30, and you could call and talk with them at 260-745-9090. WBCL shares the gospel around the world thanks to the giving of friends like you and a Hope Center with multiple locations in Fort Wayne, extending the love and compassion of Christ through pregnancy testing, ultrasounds, STD testing, and peer counseling. Find out more on our business partners page at wbcl.org. Mitch, there's a trend in family businesses. The first generation sacrifice and work very hard to establish a business. The second generation runs the business that they've watched their parents build. They've seen what's gone into it. The third generation has probably only known the business as the unlimited provider of finances, and there's a tendency to drain the company dry. What can families do to avoid the third generation crisis?
Train them to think like owners. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've watched parents spoil their kids, and then they wonder why they have problems as adults. They have to be, I really think, and my dad is would be the first to tell you he's not perfect, but the one thing my dad did was he treated me like an owner early on. He gave me responsibility and authority, and he demanded of me, and I mean like as a kid. When we built the house on the homestead where I grew up from about 9 years on until I left, there were 13 and a half acres, and it was a hayfield that he got from my great-grandfather. And he said, Mitchell, we're going to kind of start mowing this hay and have it be our lawn. He said, I want you to go out with the old-fashioned seeder. And he said, I want you to just kind of like sow that grass seed all over. So all over like 13 and a half acres. And so after I did that, he said, now what I want you to do is to dig every thistle. I said, Dad, this is, it just looks like, you can picture a movie, like a kid looking out, and it just seems like it's forever. And I said, what are you talking about? So the idea of incentive was a big deal to me. And I said, well, can you make it worth my while? And he said, I'll give you 10 cents for every thistle you get. I'm telling you, Peggy Sue, if it had a leaf, it was a thistle.
It was that.
Oh, that's an incentive program.
Oh, my. Oh, my word. Now I look at all, the thistles look like cash to me. And I just start filling up my little red wagon constantly, you know, all summer long.
That was your rose garden, Mitch.
But that's right. But I found something out about my dad. When it came time to, I was just building my account. To me, I was just great. And so at the end of the summer, when we settled, you should have seen his face when I told him how much he owed me.
How much was it?
Oh, it was hundreds of dollars.
My.
It was hundreds, at least. Hundreds. And he was in shock. So then I learned a lot about negotiations and people not wanting to pay and that kind of thing.
Did he come up with a new comp plan for you?
Oh, he did all kinds of stuff. It reminded me of the time that I bet him $20. I'm pretty young. That he could lose 20 pounds in 2 weeks. This is amazing. Dwayne knows dad, so Dwayne's going to die. So I'm a kid, okay? I'm a kid. Well, it comes down to what he's eating everything in those 2 weeks. He's just eating everything. We had a weigh-in, and then we had a weigh-in at the end. Well, I see him leaning like crazy against the wall as he's on the scales on the second weigh-in 2 weeks later. I said, Dad, get your hand off that thing. He kept trying to focus my eyes on the scale. Well, he had lost, according to the scales, 18 or 19 pounds. I said, Dad, there's no way. A human being doesn't lose 20 pounds in 2 weeks eating whatever he wants.
All those Twinkies.
He says, Mitchell, you're not going to hold me to this bet for being 1 pound off, are you? Well, I start pushing, and he can't hold it back any longer. At the weigh-in, the first weigh-in, he had loaded his pockets with all kinds of heavy medallions.
No, that's creative.
It's just awesome. See, yeah, my dad taught me larceny too. But you know, Proverbs actually talks about that. It talks about all the stones in the bag are of his making, and what they used to do when they would weigh out goods and services when Proverbs was written is they cheat on the mm-hmm. control bag. They mm-hmm. lower it or raise it, whatever. If it said 5 pounds on the outside, they lower what the inside really was or raise it, depending on whether they were buying or selling. And we do the same thing today with the way we manage conflict with people. But, well, there you go.
Lessons in life.
Yeah. At the weigh-in, man, put them in workout clothes.
So what you're saying then is if you want to stop that third generation crisis that seems to be pretty common, it is going to be up to the parents to really, really teach the children.
No question. You got to teach and be owners. You got to give them risk. You got to let them fail.
Amen.
I like this from Proverbs. It's in the book that's coming out. Teach, train, test, transform. Teach is I do, you watch. Train is I do, you help. Test is you do, I help. Transform is you do, I watch. Mm-hmm. My job as a parent is to get myself out of a job. It's going to bring tears in my eyes when I think about the stages my dad did with me with every one of those mm-hmm. four. And I've had conflict with my dad. You sure. know, this hasn't been smooth sailing.
Right.
When you're in an auctioneer family, the way you win an argument is you make an emotional appeal and you get louder. So I've had lots of emotional appeals and loud conversations with my father. Not so much so when God got a hold of me a different way. But it's a great challenge. I mean, it's just the same challenge everybody has. I think everybody needs to think like an owner everywhere. Mm-hmm. I think if you're an employee at a building, at a company, you got to think like the owner. And you will excel. And the customer will be so happy that you're serving.
It's a team there between the employee and the employer.
Yes.
And if you're not on the same team, you're going to wreck it up. What you were saying too about the watching, it's like don't expect what you don't inspect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a training mm-hmm. and then making sure that the training is stuck.
Yes.
I had some friends that had a business that was very successful. For their son, they sent their son out to work at another company so that he understood what it was like to be the employee before they brought him back.
Beautiful.
To be in leadership.
I know a lot of people have done that.
Yeah.
That is really smart. My dad didn't. I think he wanted to control me or manipulate. I mean, invest in me. That's what I meant.
Great choice of words. But Mitch, I think you hit it right on the head there about the parents, because the kids become a product of learned behavior, and parents are a newspaper that their kids read every day.
Mm.
They
and
really are.
As parents, we don't want to watch our kids fail. We don't
right.
want
no.
to watch them go through that, but it's going to be the best lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go to
yeah.
a sporting event.
Yeah.
And just watch how the parents interact with their kids.
Yeah. I mean, it's passive, right?
Oh, yeah. It's mind-boggling.
Goodness.
Yeah, parents, I think, all of us, I think, have a tendency to be enablers. I mean, just because of the reason mm-hmm. you talked about, we love them so much, we don't mm-hmm. want to see them hurt, so we end mm-hmm. up doing things that really mm-hmm. end up penalizing the kids,
mm-hmm.
really.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of letting them stand on their own and fail, like Mitch said, which is the best thing for it. Mistakes are always improvements, seeds for improvements, I've always said. So
yeah.
Let them make lots of mistakes. That's how you learn. That's wisdom.
Dwayne's generation worked like crazy, and I bought into that. So
are you saying I'm older than you,
Mitch?
He's
my dad's contemporary. That's all I'm saying, even though he looks younger than I am and has more hair. They worked like crazy. They took risks. You look at my dad's class, and like all of them are just high school class, local high school, all of them are so successful. It's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
They had a different mindset. I bought into that mindset. My kids' generation are watching all that and saying, whoa, I'd like to have a little family time. I'd like to go on a trip once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be shackled to this. And so the millennials are seeing this whole thing a little bit differently, and that's part of why we got what we got. And I think the solution is to go back to the Bible and see how God's designed it.
The time is 10:29. I'm Peggy Sue Wells.
It's flying by, Peggy Sue. It's flying by.
I'm Peggy Sue Wells. You're listening to WBCL's Mid-Morning. Our in-studio guests are Dwayne Ducharme and Mitch Cruz. If you have questions for Dwayne and Mitch about business, you can text your questions to 260-745-9090. That is also the number to call. Phone lines are open now. You can send your questions over Facebook, email midmorninglive@wbcl.org. We are giving away two copies of Kidpreneur, Young Entrepreneurs with Big Ideas by email. So if you have a young person age 8 to 13, email your snail mail address to us at midmorning@wbcl.org. WBCL shares the gospel around the world with comfort and hope thanks to the area businesses that team with you to support us, like Dr. Carl Myers of Indiana Vision Development Center in Fort Wayne, specializing in vision problems which interfere with reading and learning. You can find out more on our WBCL Business Partners page. You were talking about the different generations, and the current business landscape shows millennials are discovering entrepreneurship significantly earlier than the boomers did. So our generation launched first businesses roughly around age 35. The millennialpreneurs are setting out around age 27. The Institute of Women's Policy Research shows 29% of America's business owners are women, and the number of women-owned firms has grown 68% since 2007. Mm-hmm. Minority women with business ownership skyrocketed 265% since 1997. Mm-hmm. And minorities now make up 1 in 3 female-owned businesses. And Indiana is among the nation's top 5 states for employment and revenue growth in women-owned businesses. Wow. So, Dwayne, what is the advantage of having your business compared to the benefits of being an employee?
Boy, those are great questions. Having your own business, I mean, gives you... you've got unlimited opportunity, which means you've got unlimited income. You know, no cap on your income. You've got no boss to report to, or maybe your spouse.
And the IRS.
Yes. Oh, yes. I won't forget that. You control your own destiny and chart your own course, and you got complete freedom to choose, you know, what, where, when, and how, and everything. And you can take off as much time as you choose to and do it when you want to. I think that's and dreams become reality, or can come to reality in your own business. And versus the employee, I see the benefits of being an employee is that you have no personal savings invested and or economic risk regarding the ups and downs of businesses. You don't have to sign personally guaranteed banknotes, which I think almost every small business owner has to. And if you sign notes like that, the banks, the recourse, they'll come back on you personally, and you could lose everything. So as an employee, you don't have any of those risks, any of the exposure at all. And you can walk away from something if you're an employee. You can just say, I'm terminating, I walk away, and there's very little recourse as long as you can find another job and not much downside. You've got set hours as an employee, and very static. You can plan things and work the plan. You don't have to worry about business problems disrupting those plans or have to set them back. You've got time off, and benefits are all paid by the employer. One of the big ones I came up with, you don't have to deal with personnel problems, which in about 95% of the business owners I talk to, it's their number one thing. That yes. It's just so troublesome. Mm-hmm. And it's emotionally, I think, for a business owner, a real problem. Mm-hmm. It was for me. I felt lots of times like I was on a treadmill with personnel problems. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it was fun.
If you're a believer, you really end up being a pastor as a owner of a business, no question. You have a front row seat to every single thing going on in the team's lives. Mm. Huge, huge. And if you're that and you're listening today, I would just encourage you to continue to shepherd those people, because they're telling things to you and you're seeing things that their pastor at church isn't seeing. And so, you might be the only connection they have for healing.
So for business owners, the dailiness of serving customers, paying quarterly taxes, upgrading equipment, training employees, there is an intersection between that and faith.
Mm-hmm. Big time. I think it's Numbers 4. The same Hebrew word is translated work and worship, and it's all bad in Hebrew. That really is a window into the heart of God. God made it so that work would be an act of worship. Andy Granatelli, who developed STP and won the Indy 500 with Mario Andretti, is this colorful figure. It was so much fun to be around Andy. And I sold him cars, and I sold cars for him, and spent a lot of time with him socially. And he wrote in his book, They Call Me Mr. 500, that, and Andy would talk about this when you're with him, that work should be fun. Kind of what mm-hmm. Richard Branson said. Work should really, really be fun. And so I was talking to a young person who was thinking about maybe not going to college. And I'm okay with somebody, as long as they got a plan on how they're going to develop a skill set. I didn't hear that plan. So I said to this young person, I said, look, why don't you find something you love? Something you absolutely love that you would get up every morning and just be so eager to do. And go get trained to do that at a university. I said, you will be so happy and so fulfilled and so excited, but you'll have a skill set that's developed as opposed to meandering in that unique time frame that you have to go do that and then not enjoying the benefits of it later on.
We're going to talk about college here, and let's do that now. Mike Rowe, he's the host of the TV series Dirty mm-hmm. Jobs. He told the U.S. Senate that there is nearly 1.2 million jobs available. With an 8.3 national unemployment rate, there are people who can't find jobs, but there's also jobs who can't find qualified people. So, for instance, skilled welders of alloyed materials and top industrial electricians have yearly incomes of $100,000+. Mm-hmm. So for those preparing to enter the job market, how important is a college education compared to maybe vocational or trade school?
My dad used to say, it takes the doctor 20 years to catch up with the plumber. I didn't even know what he meant.
You do now.
I do now. I sure do. I think you can go either way. I don't think college is made for every single person. The unfortunate thing is a young person will hear me say that. I go, oh, there you go, man. I'm not going.
Yeah.
No, it's if you're developing a trade. Are you a son of a watchmaker? I know somebody who's a cabinet maker and he's invested in a young person to be a cabinet maker. I know somebody that's a countertop maker. He's invested in a young person to be a countertop maker. And those people are just like doing really, really well. And that is good and healthy. And that's great. But if you don't have that apprenticeship pathway, then I think you need to go the college university pathway and discover what you love. Go to Dr. John Lovell here in Fort Wayne. We got one of the best resources in the world in Fort Wayne that he'll meet with you between your junior and senior year of high school, give you testing. And he's had people check him out on this. He'll do it with adults. He's got a huge, huge track record, a high batting average, almost like Steph Curry's free throws, actually, on people getting connected to what they're made to do. And it's just fascinating. And so I think the important thing is that you have a plan and that you have a strategy to follow that plan. You don't just say, well, that school's not for me. School is kind of set up for one learning style. So I get that. But don't throw it all away just because one part's a struggle. You gotta develop a skill set that's a perceived value or you won't have a career of any kind.
And also, I have recommended to my 7 kids that they do a job shadow, because we get this idea of the job that we want to have, and then we romanticize what it's like doing that job.
Yes.
And so one of my daughters said she was going to be a teacher, and she had this idea of what that was going to look like. So I called the local school, said, can she come shadow somebody for a few days? And they said, absolutely. And at the end of that, she came back and said, I'm not going to do that, because we saw it going completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was like, okay, that wasn't for me, which saved me a lot of time and money in college training her for something that wasn't going to be a fit. And I know when I first became a reporter for the newspaper, I was kind of surprised that my first assignment was calling the funeral homes every day to see who died and writing their obituaries. And realizing, you know, in a few weeks that if I ever had a flat tire or something, the only phone numbers I had were memorized were the ones for the funeral homes.
Hello.
So the shadowing is really important. You know, make sure that this job actually is what you think it's going to be before you jump into it.
I did that with my Kelsey, who you guys know is mm-hmm. one of the sweetest people on the planet. And she couldn't decide if she wanted to be a teacher, radio and television, or counselor. And I wanted everything to like align. So I kept trying to put it all together for her, you know. Well, she did that same exact thing in classroom management. Lakewood allowed this for her. She was a cadet teacher. Classroom management convinced her she wasn't going to do that all day.
Mm-hmm.
And then she knew that she didn't want to be a professional reader as far as like television or radio, that she wanted to speak from a platform of expertise. So now, through her education at Huntington University and getting her graduate degree now in counseling, she's putting it all together finally. It's really cool. And I think she might end up teaching and using multimedia to do it in the realm of counseling.
Yeah, which is another thing that you do is, and Dwayne, you do the same thing. You guys see an opportunity, and the opportunity to make something different, the opportunity to fill a need that's not been filled yet and jump into it. So there's really this creativity and this idea-ness that comes behind somebody who's going to be a business owner and is going to start a business. Mm-hmm. What can we do that's very different? There's a recent Harvard University study that claims 3 out of 4 venture-backed firms fail. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, half of new businesses survive 5 years and 1/3 survive a decade or more. What are the common characteristics of businesses that succeed?
Capitalization and perceived value. They actually serve the customer. Almost every business fails because of lack of capitalization. That's a nice way to say they run out of money.
Yeah.
But that's it. That's what happens. And it's something like 9 out of 10 franchises succeed and 9 out of 10 non-franchises fail. It's that plan and that system that helps somebody with an entrepreneurial spirit kind of stay within the boundaries of success and not get overextended, kind of like Dwayne's talking about the marathon station. But that's the problem. So you got to be able to weather some storms. We've just had some very high profile retail establishments close in Fort Wayne in the last few months, and that's it. They weren't doing the volume to meet their expenses, and they ran out of money or weren't going to put any more money toward it. So
all about cash flow.
It really is. Yeah. And so there has to be some, Collins and Porras, I think, so you got to do 3 things. You got to do what you're passionate about. You got to figure out what you're the best in the world at. And then you got to figure out your economic engine. And if those 3 things go together, then you got something. That's the problem, is the economic engine part. I got a daughter that's got an art gift. And I said, well, there might not be a lot of money in that until you die. Yeah. So we need to talk about, you know, how we're going to explore that. But it's running out of resources. And it's sometimes it can be a great plan that's not funded well. Other times you just didn't have enough success at the beginning to keep it going. Proverbs 13:11 says that we take in our resources little by little. That's the way God's designed it. Hardly anybody buys, Dwayne might have, but hardly anybody buys a building for $1 million and sells it for $10 million the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't really happen. The markets frown on somebody. You're not going to buy a stock for $1,000 and it's going to be $2,000 the next day. That just doesn't happen much in our world. It's God's designed it. It really is little by little. So you got to have something that's an economic engine. You're the best in the world at, and it's your passion, and it can go little by little.
Mm-hmm. That's good, Mitch. When I look at why businesses failed, I've got a what I call a due diligence list that I use. It's my 8 P's. I call them P is like in Paul.
Yeah.
And I use this when mentoring either startup businesses or people that are in business, primarily for startups. And Mitch hit it right on the head. Principle, I call it, which is one of the P's. Principle is money, and it's the biggest reason for people failing, because they're undercapitalized when they go in. They're unrealistic about their expectations, are unrealistic about the expenses that they're going to have, or the time that's going to take to bring something on the market, either goods or service, and turn it into a profit. The other big one, I think, is people. You got to have the right people, and businesses fail because business owners, or they'll hire B or C's, I call them. There's A, B, and C people. Well, if you hire an A person, all you got to do is point them and let them go. Get out of their way. Your job should be to support them and make sure the roadblocks and obstacles are out of their way and let them succeed for you.
Because they're self-governing. They're
right.
Going to see what needs to be done, and they're going to do it.
Right. The A's will lead, where the B's and C's will be followers. And if you hire a B or a C and allow yourself to settle for that as far as somebody running your companies, the B's and C's will never attract A's. They never will. They're threatened by them. Mm-hmm. So they'll never bring them on. So your business might grow, but it'll never hit the exponential potential that it has.
And it's the right people in the right place.
Amen. Yeah,
based
all
on
about,
what their talents are.
All about leadership.
That's what Vince Lombardi was so good at.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you going to do the other 6 P's? Because I'm writing them down.
Sure, yeah. Planning. P, planning, just business plans with realistic budgets and forecasts.
Mm-hmm.
It's a key thing. I talk to people and they say, well, I'm going into business. And they say, well, what are you doing? Well, I don't know. I'm just going to go into business. Mm-hmm. I see that like going out to the Fort Wayne International Airport, walking up to a ticket agent and say, I want to go someplace. Well, where do you want to go? When do you want to come back? How long you going to, you know,
mm-hmm.
what airline you want to go on? There's a lot of things that goes into it. Just winging it like that. And the place, you know, it's a geographic. Are you in the right place for it?
Yes.
You don't want to be selling air conditioners in Alaska,
yes.
or snow machines in Florida. I mm-hmm. mean, it's a minor thing. It's probably at the bottom of the eight that I look at.
There were only two car museums that made a profit, and they were both where there was high level of foot traffic. One of them would claim he did, but you can't factor the value of his cars. You couldn't have made that a profit.
Yeah. Another P is the period, or is the timing right?
Mm.
You know, it could be premature to go into a market, or it could be too late to get into it. It could be that you're looking at, you know, obsolescence, the thing going out of vogue already. In the product, do you really have product and services that fills an immediate need? Is there value added in your service or a product that you're bringing on board? And will there be an ongoing need? Promotion.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch touched on that. Marketing. He's got his three M's and I got my eight P's, but it's you've got to have a well done marketing and sales plan. And there is a difference between marketing and sales.
Yes.
And that's definite. But the biggest one, number eight, it probably should be number one, is prayer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have you committed it to prayer? And is it God's will in His timing?
Yeah.
And the prayer is going to be a little bit different than, okay, God, I'm doing this, so please bless it. It's going to be more like, God, is this what you are calling
exactly.
me to do?
Exactly.
I got to hear Henry Nouwen speak before he passed away. I can almost remember word for word. It was one of the most powerful things I've ever experienced. And he talked about how we tend to go out and do ministry or start a business. When it doesn't work so well, we huddle up together and say, okay, why isn't this working? And then finally we start praying, oh God, please make this work.
Yeah.
And he said, Jesus did it backwards. He did solitude and he prayed with the Father. He had community with the disciples, and out of solitude and community comes ministry or your business. The way I would rephrase that is be, do, go. Mm-hmm. Don't come into your pastor's office and say you want to start this business and you've never done that business before in your life. That's just not gonna, it's got to flow out of who you are, what you do and what you've done, and then God can take the go to the next ripple effect, the next level.
Yeah, you got to have the skill sets.
Yeah.
It's going to fail.
And you're going to fail, but mistakes and failures are only mistakes and failures if you don't learn from them and if you don't move forward with it. And I've also heard that overnight success takes 10 years.
that's really good.
But don't expect that to happen really overnight. The codicil that we've talked about is, you know, why businesses are succeeding, why they're going to fail. How is doing business in 2017 going to be different than it's been in past years?
Go ahead, Mitch.
Well, it's faster. I'm going to tell you what's going to be the biggest difference this year and probably the next four total is there'll probably be a more friendly business environment in the United States if interest rates remain low and inflation doesn't get out of control and the tax rates for businesses and individuals come way down and unnecessary regulations come way down, this economy will be absolutely on fire. It's not my opinion. It's the fact of every time anything like this has happened in our 200 and some years. So I think it's a great time to be in the marketplace, if God's prompting you, if it's the be, do, go thing, if it's time to take that first, I'm telling you, I think the time is right. I think it's going to explode.
Oh, Mitch, I agree with you 100%. I'm a strong believer in supply side economics, mm-hmm. you know, deregulation and lower taxes. And I think the difference this year is, like you talked about, if we can see these taxes and all this government regulation and the so onerous for business, you know, the red tape and the restriction roadblocks and everything, this this economy is going to explode. Mm-hmm. I really do. And if they cut the corporate tax.
Mm-hmm. And bring all the money in.
Yes, yes, yes.
The holiday to bring all the money
in. Yeah, because the companies will reinvest in plants and equipment, which is going to create more jobs. It's mm-hmm. just, I see millions of people going back to work.
I think it's going to be really amazing.
And if they cut the personal income tax also, mm-hmm. all that consumer money is going to come back into the market, which is just going to fuel the economy more. I do. I'm not an economist. I don't pretend to be an economist. But I just think this is going to be an incredible, robust year. And it's time to be fully invested.
Yeah, it's time to take a risk, for sure.
Yeah, and full disclosure, I do not own a stock company or anything, okay? I'm trying to make stock sales. But all that is provided we don't have some sort of calamity in the world, some sort of a terrorist, huge terrorist attack, or just a full blown war. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that happens, well, all bets are off on that.
Mm-hmm.
It changes the economy.
Changes the whole landscape mm-hmm. worldwide. Yeah, it's fragile out there. There's no question about it.
With the internet, that's websites, all that kind of stuff. I'm seeing a lot of people that have businesses that are doing well. They are no brick and mortar behind mm-hmm. them. What do you guys think about that?
A friend of mine's in the shopping center business. He buys and sells shopping centers, and he said it's killing the
really?
Strip centers. And yeah, Macy's closing 100 stores. There's just now. I mean, that's a name everybody knows, and that's a store everybody's familiar with. And man, they got it going on. But that department store segment of the industry has just diminished. And the internet is what's going on. People are buying on the internet. They're comfortable with it. And it's meeting a need. And so if you're in business, you have to adjust. You have mm-hmm. to adjust to that. That being said, I think you got to be careful by making sure that you're protected when you buy on the internet. I've had just a couple little things where you never got your goods and you couldn't call anybody to find out what happened to your money. So it's good. Credit card companies are usually pretty good about that and protect the consumer. But there's a lot of potential there, a ton of potential. I want to say this, though. The other side of the internet is I think it is social media and the internet and everybody communicating that way has brought about this tremendous value of people with people skills, people who can communicate. I mean, have you noticed? You can go through about any drive-through, any retail establishment, and if you got some young people there, a lot of times, man, they're not communicating so well. And that's just unheard of. I mean, that's just any business person in the world. A little kid could tell you, you better treat those people real well and find out what they need when they come in. Because think what they did. They saw the advertisement. They took time out of their schedule and they entered that establishment. You better take care of them. You spent a lot of money to get them in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people with people skills and the ability to communicate are going to be at a premium. If your business is advertising, sometimes you just want to talk to somebody on the phone.
Right.
So it's coming and it's going to come strong. I predicted it 20 years ago and it's coming so much faster than I thought it would.
E-commerce is where it's going to all happen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And service.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because if people get good service and know somebody really cares about them and is going to solve their problem, they're going to be back.
Oh, yeah.
So
I think communication also is a huge problem out there. Like you said, you go into stores and everything. It's just it's like it's lost art anymore.
Yes.
Everybody, all the young kids text. I mean, you can't talk to them. My grandchildren won't answer my phone calls, but they'll answer a text.
Yeah.
That's the way they want to communicate.
And sometimes we're texting across the room to each other.
Yes,
or next to each other
church.
On the couch. Yeah.
Sitting in church, text back and forth. Yeah.
Is that what you were doing during my sermon the other day? I thought you had your Bible app out.
If you ask, they will say they've got the Bible pulled up there. What is something that you know now about business that you wish you would have known when you were getting started? Maybe something that you share with people that come to you, because both of you will mentor people that are in business or going into business.
I'm going to tell you a story and tell you why I kind of developed the perspective. I had a competitor who ran an auction about a week after me or a week before me in the same city, and he was very successful. I felt as though he embellished his success at such a exaggerated level that he was forcing me to do the same thing, and I'm doing the God owns my business thing. So I'm memorizing the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm reciting it every night as far as I've gone in it. And kind of get to, I'm thinking about this, I'm praying about my business, I'm praying about my auctions coming up, and this comes in my mind, the competitor and all this. And I said, and God says, you know, basically love and pray for your enemy. And that's how I'm looking at my competitor. And I wanted to, but I just couldn't, mm-hmm. you know. And I couldn't pray for him to be blessed in the same way I had just asked God to bless everything else in my life. So my flippant prayer was, God, you know, I hope he knows you or finds you. You know, that's what it's all about anyway. Well, he and I are up one morning walking through a courtyard in a city where we have an auction that evening. So that's why we're both kind of there. And he's at a park bench. And I don't want him to see me. And I got my fresh squeezed orange juice and my bagel after working out that morning. But my bald head shows, you know, and he sees me. And I'm telling you, I did not quite have this much of a relationship with him, just kind of superficial, but known each other forever. So I sit down on the bench beside him. And he's probably 10 or 15 years older than I am. And he runs his fingers through his long hair, which just made me mad. And he says these words. He says, God is with me again today. And I'm thinking of the most spiritual thing I can say. And I look at him and I say, no way. What are you talking about? I really did. It came out. And I learned that he had gone to an AA meeting and he'd surrendered his life to God. And
recently.
Yeah.
Great.
Yep. And I walked away from that saying, God, I got problems. Mm. And here's my point. There's enough to go around. There's enough to go around. And I wish I'd have known that sooner. I was too greedy early on. And I think I damaged relationships. I think I damaged myself. I think I created unfair expectations. And, you know, and when I started studying the Bible for myself, I realized that greed's idolatry. You know, that competitor contracted a very rare disease and died about a year later. Mm. And right before he died, I remember him coming across my auction arena where people had their cars. And in his hand was an envelope with 110 titles of people who were consigning cars after his auction to mine. That would have never happened. That was a God thing that he's bringing them to me and say, here, Mitch, these guys say they're bringing their cars to you. I want to make sure you have their titles, wow. You know, so they don't try to sell them outside the auction or something like that. And I just wish I'd have known that there's enough to go around. God can bless everyone and not be so greedy.
Because God is a God of abundance and not scarcity.
Yeah. Yes.
Dwayne?
Yeah, what?
And you've got like a minute.
Yeah. Okay, great. I
thought I gave you five, Dwayne. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mitch pushed me out of this. That's all right. No, I wish I'd known younger is the enormous amount of time and effort it takes to run a successful business and how easy it is to con myself and rationalize the neglected time with my family. Mm. I used to convince myself that, I'll just give them quality of time instead of quantity of time. But you need both.
And a lot of times it's, I'm doing this for you.
Oh, yeah. That's a self-centered trip. Mm. I mean, that's an excuse. We do it because it's our pride and ego. We want to succeed and everything. And then we use that as an excuse for the time away from the families and everything. I don't agree with that. Mitch and I had similar roles. I mean, we were both obsessed with money and put God on the shelf. But he was smarter than I was. He built his business up to an apex, sold out, and then went and spent quality time with his daughters, where I kept going on. So that's why I respect him. He's my role model.
And I felt prompted by God to do that. I mean, I can tell how I ding my oldest daughter much more than the other three because of how I lived when she was a little girl.
When she was young. Dwayne Deshaun.
Sorry, Megan.
And Dr. Mitch Cruz.
Yeah, it was great being here. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being our guest today, sharing your experience, your expertise, and hope about the business of business. Later today, this interview with Dwayne and Mitch will be available online on the Mid-Morning Archives. Now for tomorrow, practical plug into life, get healthy information. Tune in tomorrow when we will have fitness expert Carrie Zerbach as our guest on Mid-Morning. Stay tuned right now. Music is next with Ken Church on family-friendly, commercial-free WBCL.